This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. The New South Wales flood disaster is moving north, with evacuation orders in the Hunter region, flooding expected on the central coast, and severe weather forecast to hit the mid-north coast. There were 55 flood rescues overnight, and while the rains eased in Sydney, tens of thousands of residents in the southwest and northwest are still isolated or unable to return home, as Gavin Coote reports.
As the Hawkesbury River swirls to its highest level in decades, there have been frantic efforts to get people to safety and move cars, trucks and other machinery out of the flood zone. Boats are the only option for people like Wayne Smith, who's been crisscrossing the flooded river for days now.
Spent a lot of hours awake moving gear from low areas to higher areas, and then moving gear from higher areas to even higher areas. That's about the whack of it.
The floodwaters have now surpassed the level recorded in the earlier disaster in March this year. And at Lower Portland, where Wayne Smith lives, power and communications outages are only making it more difficult to check up on other locals.
This morning we had to go over, and the brother-in-law and sister come over in a tinny to let us know that our neighbour had slipped over and broke his ankle, so we had to go over there and do a quick recovery and bring him over to his daughter, and his daughter took him to hospital. And at the same time, we had to go over and empty their house back out because it was going underwater as well. Yeah, so my niece is over there, her house has gone underwater, my sister's house has gone underwater, my neighbour's house has... we're going to go and check shortly, but it's just gone in under the doors in there.
How's your house?
My house, luckily, is the last one built on the property, so it's the highest. Yeah, we're okay. We've just got no electricity or no communication.
A bit further upstream, Ken Anderson is watching the Hawkesbury raging like he's never seen before.
They all reckon the peninsula that I'm on is slows the flood down. That's true too. It slows the flood down.
This peninsula is home to Ken Anderson's caravan park and orchard. His house remains high and dry, and about 80 caravans have been towed uphill. But 2,000 of his orange trees are now underwater.
All my income's gone, and I'll be losing a lot of trees this time as well, because they only just survived last year, some of them. And they're recuperating, but this will kill them, I think, now. Yeah, this is the highest I can remember now. This is the highest I've ever seen.
Back at Lower Portland, Wayne Smith's family was only just getting back on their feet after the March floods. They just repaired their houses and reopened their own caravan park 2 weeks ago.
So this will be the fifth flood in 30 months that we've had to close the business down, and it usually takes us around 8 months to recover.
The houses, your sisters and your nieces, will they be salvageable?
That we think it will be salvageable. It's getting to a point now where it's probably not, because there's no point, there's no point in putting an investment into something that keeps going underwater.
That's Wayne Smith, a resident on the Hawkesbury River northwest of Sydney, ending Gavin Coote's report. Part of the reason that interest rates have risen for a third month in a row is the Reserve Bank is trying to tackle the high cost of living, pushing down inflation. But grocery prices could stay high because the New South Wales floods have washed away millions of dollars of vegetables. Annie Guest reports.
The Daily Shop at a local grocery store in South Brisbane.
Lemons, because we're having fish for tea. Bananas, I'll get a couple of mandarines. Just a few things.
But she's concerned food is taking an increasing slice out of her household budget.
They're continuing to increase, especially if we want veggies with dinner. We're just more careful and we try to buy what's in season and come to these little places because they seem to be cheaper.
The owner here says suppliers continue raising prices and it's a constant strain. In Sydney, Luke Kohler agrees. He sources food directly from growers and from markets for restaurants and cafes.
Everyone knows about the iceberg lettuce. That's a record. I've never seen that in my life. Turned all the head to iceberg lettuce. But the staples that you used to be in good value, broccoli, $10 a kilo. Cauliflowers, $6, $8 each. Tomatoes, $6 a kilo minimum. Zucchini, $8, $9, $10 a kilo. Like, these are in some cases, 200% more than we're used to paying.
Prices have been pushed up by supply problems caused by floods and labour shortages reducing harvests, along with high fuel and fertiliser costs. Some economists think prices might now be slowly heading down. But Luke Kohler is pessimistic about the losses from the latest New South Wales floods.
Crops were recovering. We were on track to be back to some sort of normality throughout August, but now we're probably back to where we were 6 weeks ago now.
So when might food get cheaper again?
I believe that the prices that we've been used to over the last decade of fruit and vegetables are gone due to those higher input costs and no end in sight in them in the short term of that changing. But in terms of these ridiculously high prices, we will not see a change of these until we move into new season crops out of Victoria. They're not ready until mid-spring.
Produce wholesalers are represented by Fresh Markets Australia. General Manager Gail Woods agrees with the supply pressures, but says prices are only as high as customers are prepared to pay.
There are many commodities that's not affecting a lot of tree plants. For example, avocados has a very good supply at the moment. So, you know, your apples, there's a very big citrus season commenced, so there's a significant amount of citrus around it at good prices.
Gail Woods from Fresh Markets Australia ending Annie Guest's report. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's political career is again in peril. After narrowly surviving a confidence vote last month, senior cabinet ministers have now quit over his handling of sexual misconduct allegations. A growing number of his colleagues are now publicly questioning Boris Johnson's honesty, but the Prime Minister is hanging on. Europe correspondent Nick Dole reports from London.
Millions of Britons were sitting down to the 6 o'clock news when suddenly one of the country's most senior ministers pulled the pin.
In the last few minutes, news that the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, has just resigned.
Moments later, the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, also quit. In letters to the Prime Minister, they expressed their dismay about the standards Boris Johnson is setting. While the illegal parties at number 10 have been a major source of angst, this latest scandal is centred on the Prime Minister's response to allegations of sexual misconduct. Last week, the Tory deputy whip, Chris Pincher, admitted drinking too much and embarrassing himself. It's alleged he groped two men at a private club in London. It's since emerged that when Boris Johnson appointed him to the role, he knew that he'd been accused of sexual impropriety several years before as well. That's despite Number 10 and several ministers denying that fact for days. Overnight, Boris Johnson issued a mea culpa.
Well, look, it was a long time ago and it was only raised orally with me, but that is no excuse. I mean, I should have acted on it. Yeah, what I wanted was to give Chris Pincher, if not the benefit of that, then the ability to prove that he could do better. That was the wrong decision, and I bitterly regret it.
The Prime Minister also didn't deny he'd used the phrase pincher by name, pincher by nature. This latest scandal is only adding to concerns among Tory members and some former party heavyweights that this Prime Minister is loose with the truth. Michael Heseltine was a senior member of Margaret Thatcher's government.
I know Boris well. He took over my constituency. I like him, I get on well with him on a personal level, but that is often the case with real rogues. They can be entertaining and good company, providing you can live with a lack of integrity.
Boris Johnson's election win in 2019 destroyed Labour's hold over some of its most traditional territory. The MPs who were swept to power believe Mr Johnson has a certain X factor with voters who support his approach to Brexit. Under party rules, the Prime Minister will be spared from another confidence vote after surviving the last one. But there's a real threat those rules could be changed. MP Jacob Rees-Mogg is one of the Prime Minister's most loyal supporters. He says the backbench shouldn't be spooked by a few cabinet resignations, no matter how senior they are.
The Prime Minister, with a mandate from the British people and a majority in the House of Commons, is the one who appoints cabinet ministers, not somebody who is brought down by cabinet ministers.
Mr Rees-Mogg believes the Prime Minister can still win a general election, but there's no guarantee he'll ever get the chance again. This is Nick Dole in London reporting for AM.
Police in the United States say a man accused of carrying out a mass shooting at an Independence Day parade had spent weeks planning the attack. The death toll has risen to 7, with more than 30 people injured. Here's North America correspondent Jade McMillan.
In the community of Highland Park, north of Chicago, what should have been the site of a family-friendly event remains a crime scene. Dr. Wendy Binstock Rush was among those who'd lined the streets to watch the Independence Day parade. But when shots were fired into the crowd, her training kicked in. Telling American network NBC, she performed CPR on a man who later died in hospital.
It's very emotional time for our community. I think our community is very strong. We will support each other. I believe we will heal, but we'll never forget. And this is something that has scarred our community.
Police have accused Robert E. Cremo III of climbing onto the roof of a local business with a high-powered rifle similar to an AR-15 before firing more than 70 rounds. He's alleged to have spent weeks preparing for the attack. And police spokesman Chris Covelli claims he also had a plan for how to get away.
During the attack, Cremo was dressed in woman's clothing, and investigators do believe he did this to conceal his facial tattoos and his identity and help him during the escape with the other people who were fleeing the chaos.
Officers are reviewing a series of social media posts from the 21-year-old in the lead-up to the shooting, but say they haven't yet established a motive. He was later pulled over in a car he'd taken from his mother's house. A second rifle was found inside the vehicle. Both guns are believed to have been purchased legally. Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering says she can't understand why the weapons are so readily available.
Frankly, it tells us that our values are askew. Yesterday, we came together as a community to celebrate independence and freedom after 2 years of not having a parade. We were ready to come together as a community and celebrate our nation. And in fact, as a result, because of this gun culture, our nation turned its back on us and turned its back on our celebration.
It's a feeling echoed by local resident Bobby Katz Hinden, who escaped the shooting with her daughter and her 3-year-old grandson. She spoke to CNN.
I'm done. I don't want people's prayers. I don't want their sympathy. We have to do something about this. This is craziness.
A plea for change in a country where more than a dozen other mass shootings were reported over the same long weekend.
Jade McMillan. After the threats of blackouts, soaring power prices and all the upheaval in the East Coast's energy market, it's probably no surprise that consumer confidence is collapsing. A new survey shows people are losing faith in the ability of the system to deliver affordable and reliable power. Here's energy reporter Daniel Mercer.
Ian Davies has had 3 years he'd rather forget. First, there was the Banking Royal Commission that limited finance to his Sydney fabric printing business. Then there were the COVID-induced lockdowns that slashed demand for his products. Finally, there was this year's energy crisis, which has brought yet more misery.
The immediate problem is our electricity supplier has just more than doubled our payment plan with 2 weeks' notice. It's taking it from $870 a week, which we're just able to manage, to $2,053 a week. Now, that's $100,000 a year in electricity, and we just don't use that. So how they work this out, I've got no idea. If we don't pay the weekly payment, they'll just cut us off.
For the 65-year-old, the price hikes are a cruel blow that could well send his business to the wall. He invested all of his life savings into what he says is an exciting technology, but energy costs may be the straw that breaks him.
I mean, I rang them straight away and I said, look, I'm almost in tears. I can't take much more. Surely this is a mistake. And they said, oh, I'll put you through to this. I said, I'm just not able to hold myself together to talk to another department. Please investigate the matter and send me an email and find out why I'm paying over double. You know, it's been a hard 3 years.
Across the East Coast, consumers are similarly fed up with the energy system. In its 6-monthly survey of users, the body that represents household and small business customers found collapsing confidence in the market's ability to deliver affordable and reliable power.
We've got a trust problem.
Lynn Gallagher is the Chief Executive of Energy Consumers Australia.
The verdict from consumers on the last few weeks is that the energy system is failing them. We've seen double-digit price increases being announced. We've had retailers saying that they don't want their customers to stay with them. We've had people being worried that the power is going to go out on a cold winter day and a cold winter night. The outcome of all of that is only 4 in 10 Australians say that they have confidence that the energy market is acting in their interests.
She says much more could be done to make Australian homes more energy efficient, but governments also need to put in place policies that will guide investment as the grid switches away from fossil fuels.
I think the focus for policymakers has to be on ensuring that the investment that's needed in the future energy system, that's in large-scale generation assets, in storage, in transmission, is efficient, that we're fully utilising the capacity of all of those assets. We need to make sure that every dollar that's invested returns full benefits to consumers.
The Australian Energy Council, which represents big power providers, says an unprecedented coincidence of events has driven the increases in wholesale power prices. A spokesman says charges will vary according to the retailer, but consumers are always advised to shop around for a better deal. Small business owner Ian Davies isn't optimistic about the road ahead.
Energy is critical to manufacture. We're small manufacture. I'd love to put a bunch of solar panels on the roof, but where am I going to get the money for that? You know, things don't look bright unless the government takes control. I can't see that the prices are going to come down.
Small business owner Ian Davies ending Daniel Mercer's report. A medication to treat opioid overdoses is now freely available under a new national program. Pharmacists can provide naloxone without a prescription, a move that health professionals say will save lives. John Daly reports.
More than 110,000 Australians struggle with opioid addiction, and several people fatally overdose every day. Margaret Millington is from the Victorian town of Nil, and her son is one of those statistics. In 2010, he died after years of battling an addiction to the prescription painkiller OxyContin.
He became addicted to that accidentally after a car accident, and for 16 years we virtually watched his decline. And I think that opioid use has become epidemic in Australia now.
The federal government is spending $19.6 million on a 4-year program to provide a medication called naloxone, capable of rapidly treating opioid overdose. It's free of charge with no prescription for anyone who may experience or witness an opioid overdose and is administered as a nasal spray or injection. Margaret Millington says removing barriers to the treatment is an important step.
When my son was in the depths of his addiction, I'm sure had it been administered, Simon would still be with us today.
The national rollout follows a 2-year trial in New South Wales, South Australia and Western Australia. Faye Sim is the president of the Australian Pharmaceutical Society. Her pharmacy took part in the trial.
Even just during that pilot trial period, take-home naloxone have saved 3 lives each day. So imagine the impact now when we roll this out nationwide. I think we can safely say that and confidently say that we would expect that many more lives will be saved.
Faye Sim says stigma around accessing and using naloxone is still a problem because of its association with illicit opioids such as heroin. But she says prescription medication causes the majority of overdoses.
Prescription opioids actually cause 75% of this. So what we are suggesting is that everyone should carry naloxone. Of course, including anyone who is on any form of opioids should always carry naloxone, including their friends and family around them.
The development comes as opioid deaths in Australia are rising.
And opioid deaths have actually doubled in the last decade, so we're definitely in the upward trend.
Rebecca Lang, Chief Executive of the Queensland Network of Alcohol and Drug Agencies, says the program may also encourage people addicted to opioids to access other supports.
Because it says to the people who use opioids in our community that we care about you as a system.
that sense of self-worth is a really important sort of baseline factor for people choosing to access other types of treatment.
Margaret Millington hopes others will be spared her family's pain.
The loss of a loved one, especially one of your children, is devastating, more so when it could have been prevented.
That's Margaret Millington, whose son died of an opioid overdose, John Daly reporting. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. What's going on with the weather? After months of torrential rain up and down the east coast, New South Wales is being hit again by severe flooding. Today, my colleague Gavin Coote takes us to the hardest hit communities. And University of New South Wales climate scientist Argos Santoso explains why there could be much more rain to come. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.